Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 37.
It's 3 in the morning. Tang Sansong is in the meditation hall. He's at the Bonlin Temple, and he's been reading some heavy texts.
He's tired, honestly, kind of drowsing off over his scripture case.
And then, bam, that quiet exhaustion is just shattered. The source describes this sudden, like, almost explosive wind.
It's not just a breeze, you know. It's shaking the buildings, knocking things over, leaves flying everywhere, clouds swirling.
Right, exactly. The lamp's flickering like crazy. Tang's heart is pounding. He's only half asleep, but he's totally aware of this wild storm outside. And then, through all that wind, he hears it. A voice, just outside the hall, calling out, "Shuf!" Tang's immediate reaction. It tells you so much about what he's already been through on this journey.
Oh, absolutely. His first thought, demon. Definitely a demon. Or maybe a spirit. Coming to mess with him. And he doesn't pull any punches either. He basically tells the voice, "Look, I'm a virtuous monk, okay? Mission from the great Tang."
Yeah.
"My disciples," he says, "are total badasses." He uses these great phrases. "Dragon subduing, tiger vanquishing heroes. Monster sweeping, demon removing strong men." He's like, "If they saw you, they'd tear you limb from limb. So my advice, get lost, mercifully."
He really lays it out there. But the voice insists, "No, no, I'm not a demon, not a monster."
Mm-hmm.
And this makes Tang pause. He looks closer, and this is where it gets really interesting. The figure standing right there in the storm, it's a king.
Oh, a king. Just standing outside in a storm like that, describe this guy for us. The text gives such specific, vivid details.
It's quite an image. He's decked out in full royal gear, this heaven-reaching crown, a jade belt, this amazing robe with flying dragons and phoenixes, ochre yellow, fancy shoes. And he's holding this scepter, a white jade scepter, supposedly with constellations on it. His face is compared to these powerful deities, the Eastern Peak Emperor, the Wenchang Emperor, clearly high status. But he's standing outside, soaking wet and just weeping.
Wow. Tang is like completely shocked, right? He immediately bows, calls him your majesty, tries to help him inside. But then his hands just pass right through him. He grabs nothing.
Yeah, it's substantial.
So Tang sits back down, probably freaked out, looks again. And yep, still there, still the spectral king. He has to ask, "Who are you? Where are you from? And why are you here like this, fleeing at midnight?"
And the figure spills it. He says he's from Wuji Guo, the Wuji Kingdom, which is apparently just 40 west of the temple, so what, like 12 miles? Mm-hmm. His kingdom, he explains, faced this absolutely devastating drought, started 5 years back. The land was barren. People were starving. Just awful.
And Tang, you know, being the wise monk, gives him some advice, suggests maybe it's a sign from heaven, tells him to show compassion, open the granaries, repent, free anyone wrongly accused. Standard procedure for restoring harmony.
Right, sound advice. But the king says, "Look, my granaries were empty. I did share the hardships, just like King Yu."
Mm-hmm.
He prayed day and night for 3 years straight, he says, but nothing. The rivers, the wells, still totally dry. Then, he continues, 3 years ago, this Quanzhen Taoist shows up from Zhongyan Mountain. And this Taoist wasn't just any Taoist. He supposedly had incredible powers. Could call wind and rain. Could even turn stone into gold.
Whoa, okay. A miracle worker. Just pops up when they need him most. Seems like the answer to their prayers.
Exactly what the king thought. He invites him to pray for rain, and boom, the Taoist delivers. Loads of rain, actually, because the drought was so bad. The king is massively impressed, hugely relieved. So much so, he becomes sworn brothers with this Taoist.
Okay, so sworn brother, miracle worker, rainmaker, gold maker. What could possibly go wrong? This sounds like a perfect setup.
Yeah, you'd think so. But here's where this story takes that really, really dark turn. The king explains they were buddies, companions for only about 2 years. Then one spring day, they're walking in the royal garden. They're near this specific well, the octagonal glazed tile well. The Taoist throws something into the well, makes a golden light appear, tricks the king, says, "Hey, look at this." And when the king leans over to look, the Taoist suddenly violently shoves him in.
What? No, he just pushed the king into the well.
Push him right in, yeah. And immediately after, the Taoist covers the well with a huge stone slab, piles earth on top, plants a banana tree over it, completely hides the evidence. And the figure, talking to Tang Sanzong, he reveals he is that king. He's been dead for 3 years, a wronged ghost, drowned in that very well.
Okay, that is genuinely terrifying. Tang must be absolutely freaked out now, realizing he's talking to an actual ghost king. So he asks the obvious question, the practical one. If you died 3 years ago, how did nobody notice? The officials, the queens, how did no one look for you? How did this Taoist get away with it?
And this is where you see the sheer extent of this Taoist's power and his deception. The Ghost King explains that the moment he pushed him in, the monster, because that's what he calls him now, transformed into the king's exact likeness. Mm-hmm. Utterly indistinguishable, apparently. So this imposter has been sitting on the throne for 3 years, controlling the whole kingdom. And everyone, all the officials, the three queens, the six consorts, they all follow him. They're completely fooled.
That's incredible deception. Wow. Tang even calls the Ghost King kind of weak for not, you know, going to the underworld authorities, filing a complaint.
Which seems like a fair point, doesn't it? If you've been murdered and usurped, surely you report it to the kings of hell or someone.
Hmm.
But the ghost explains, basically his hands are tied. This monster isn't just powerful on Earth. He's got connections, serious connections in the spirit world bureaucracy.
Connections? Like what kind of connections are we talking about here? This sounds juicy.
Oh, yeah. According to the Ghost King, the Chen Kuang, the city god, that's his drinking buddy, the Dragon King of the Sea, a relative, the Eastern Peak Emperor, a good friend, the Ten Kings of Hell themselves, they're his sworn brothers too.
Whoa, okay, yeah, that's quite the network.
So, if the underworld is a dead end, why approach Tang Sanzang in the living world? Well, the ghost says he wouldn't have even dared come near the temple normally because of all the powerful guardians protecting it. You know, the...
Ah, right. Those are the celestial protectors, the bodyguards that follow Tang Sanzang everywhere.
Precisely. He couldn't get past them on his own. But, he says, the Yushen, the night patrol god, sent a specific gust of wind that literally delivered him right to Tang's meditation hall.
So he didn't just stumble upon the temple. He was deliberately sent there.
Yes, exactly. The night patrol god apparently told the ghost, look, your 3 years of water suffering are over. Go see Tang Sanzang. And here's the crucial part for our heroes. The night patrol god also told him that Tang Sanzang has a senior disciple, the great sage equal to heaven.
Sun Wukong, of course.
Yep. And the night patrol god specifically mentioned Wukong is extremely good at, well, subduing monsters.
Uh-huh. Okay, there it is, the connection. So the ghost's whole mission now is basically to beg Tang Sanzang. Please, please send your super powerful disciple to Wuji Kingdom. Capture this demon. Reveal the truth. He promises he'll repay the kindness, naturally.
That's the core request, yeah.
Tang gets it. Okay, so you want my disciple Wukong to go sort out this monster king? The ghost is all for it. But Tang, even though he knows Wukong is perfect for monster bashing, raises a really smart, practical point. He says, essentially, this is going to be incredibly tricky. Legally speaking, politically speaking.
And this adds such a realistic layer to the fantasy, doesn't it? It's not just about magic power. The monster looks exactly like the real king. The entire court accepts him, even the queens. If Wukong and the others just charge in and start a fight, well, they'll look like traitors trying to overthrow the kingdom. They could get arrested, trapped, maybe even executed. Tang uses this great phrase, like drawing a tiger, but ending up with a dog.
Right, like a total screw-up that makes everything worse. You can't just barge in and depose a king, even if you secretly know he's an imposter. It's messy. But the ghost says, wait, there are still people loyal to me in the court. Tang hopes maybe it's someone powerful, a relative, a prince regent.
And the ghost reveals, no, it's my own son, the crown prince, Tyson.
Okay, the prince. That's promising. A direct heir. Is the prince also fooled by the imposter? Does he know?
Well, he's not exactly fooled, but he's definitely being managed. The prince is still technically in the palace. He's on the dead Shenlandian, the Golden Throne Hall, or the Hufing, the Five Phoenix Tower, studying, attending court with the imposter king. However, and this is key, it's the monster's strategy. For three solid years, the prince has been banned from the inner palace. He hasn't been allowed to see his own mother, the queen.
Whoa, wait. Why would the monster do that specifically? Keep mother and son apart.
The ghost explains it's a deliberate scheme to keep control. The monster is afraid. He fears that if the mother and son actually got together, had a real conversation, they might compare notes, notice inconsistencies. You know, maybe the imposter doesn't know some private family detail. The secret could unravel. Keeping them separated isolates them, ensures his grip on power.
That is cold and calculating. Tang even feels for the prince, right? He relates it to his own tough childhood, separated from his parents. He feels sympathy for this prince who's basically been orphaned by a monster living in his own house.
It definitely adds an emotional weight. But it raises a huge practical problem for Tang. How can they possibly meet this prince? He's essentially a prisoner in his own palace, can't even see his own mom. How do you get a message to him?
Right. seems impossible. But the ghost, resourceful even in death, has a plan for that too. He tells Tang the prince is actually going to be leaving the palace, like, the very next morning.
Oh, really? For what reason?
He's leading a hunting party.
Likely.
A big one, apparently 3,000 men, falcons, dogs, the whole deal. Outside the city walls.
Uh-huh. An opportunity. Away from the palace's immediate security.
Exactly. The ghost sees this as the perfect chance for Tang Sanzang to intercept him. He thinks if Tang tells the prince the whole story, his son will believe him.
But Tang is still skeptical, which, you know, is fair. The prince sees this imposter every day, calls him father. Why would he suddenly believe this random monk telling him this absolutely wild story about ghosts and monsters and wells? It sounds crazy.
It does sound like a hard sell. And this is where the ghost produces the clincher, the proof.
Right, the physical evidence needed to connect the ghost story to the prince's reality.
The ghost says, I'll leave you a token. Tang asks what it is. And the ghost places that very scepter he was holding right there on the ground, the Jingxiong Baiyugu.
The gold-inlaid white jade ghee scepter, the one I described earlier. The royal regalia.
Exactly. And the ghost explains why it's so important. When the Taoist monster transformed into the king, he couldn't replicate the specific scepter. It was unique, maybe magically protected, who knows.
Oh, okay, so the imposter doesn't have it.
Right, and to cover his tracks, the imposter told the whole court that the Taoist, the Rainmaker guy, had actually stolen the scepter. So officially, it's been missing for 3 years.
Gotcha. So if the prince sees this specific missing scepter,
he'll recognize it instantly. And seeing it, the ghost says, will make him think of his real father. That phrase, du wu seren, seeing the object, makes you remember the person.
Right. It provides that concrete link. The story suddenly becomes believable because here's the missing proof.
It'll ignite his desire for revenge, make him trust Tang's incredible story. So the scepter, it's not just regalia, it's the key piece of evidence.
That's actually brilliant. A very clever plot device.
Tang agrees. Okay, he'll keep the scepter. He'll have his disciple handle the monster removal. He asks the ghost, okay, where will you wait while we sort this out?
But the ghost says he can't wait around in the human realm. He needs to get back. His final act before heading back to the spirit world is to ask the night patrol god for one more favor. Another gust of wind, please, but this time to send him back to the inner palace.
Why the inner palace?
His plan is to appear in a dream, specifically to the principal queen, the prince's mother. He believes if he can warn her in a dream, then mother and son will be aligned. They'll both be ready to cooperate with Tang's disciples, creates allies inside.
A two-pronged approach. Contact the prince in person with the proof. Contact the queen in a dream. Smart.
Very strategic. Tang agrees to this plan. The ghost thanks him and asks the night patrol god for that wind. Poof, he's gone. And the storm outside starts to die down.
Wow, okay. So just like that, a quiet night of meditation turns into, well, this. A chilling encounter with a ghost king. We've got this years-long deception uncovered, a shape-shifting monster pulling the strings with friends in high and low spiritual places, a rightful king drowned in a well, an imposter on the throne, a loyal but totally isolated prince, and this whole mission now hinges on a jade scepter and hopefully a convincing dream.
It's a fantastic setup, isn't it? It blends the supernatural ghosts, magic, deities with really human stuff. Usurpation, loyalty, the search for justice, even the difficulty of proving the truth. And you see the like practical details needed, even in this magical world. You need evidence the prince will actually accept. You need communication between allies, mother and son.
It really sets the stage perfectly for our heroes Wukong, Baji, Xia Wujing to step in. But it's clear it won't just be about brute force this time. They're going to need proof. They'll need some diplomacy, maybe some clever tricks. And they've got this fragile alliance built on a ghost's word and a dream. It's far more complex than just, you know, beating up a random demon.
Definitely. Yeah. What really stands out is how those mundane details, the hunting party schedule, that specific jade scepter, become intertwined with the totally supernatural stuff. The ghost, the shapeshifter, the underworld connections. It all creates this really layered, complex problem for them to solve.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a monster waiting in a cave. It was a whole conspiracy.
Makes you think, doesn't it? In a situation where reality itself seems to be faked, where someone can perfectly imitate another, what kind of proof would you actually need to believe such an impossible truth? Something to mull over. Tang Sanzang wakes up really disturbed, immediately calling for his disciples, you know, Sun Wukong, Zhu Baji, Xia Seng.
And how do they take being woken up in the middle of the night? I can imagine Zhu Baji wasn't thrilled.
Oh, not at all. Zubaji is, well, classic Baji, a bit grumpy, complaining about, you know, being a servant.
Right.
He's like, I used to be a demon, eating whatever I wanted. Now look at me carrying bags. So, yeah, being woken by a dream is definitely not his favorite activity.
It does bring that human element into it, doesn't it? These big heroes still get annoyed by everyday stuff.
Totally. So what about Sun Wukong, the Monkey King? How does he read this situation?
Well, Wukong has a, let's say, a different perspective. Predictably different.
Right.
He sort of dismisses dreams generally.
Yeah.
Says they come from worry. And he doesn't worry. He's just focused on getting to the West.
Okay. Typical Wukong confidence.
But then, and this is the interesting part, he immediately assumes this dream must mean there's a monster impersonating the king.
Ah, so he does take it seriously, just in his own way.
Exactly. He's instantly ready for a fight. He sees problem. He thinks demon. He thinks, let's smash it.
His solution is always the cudgel, isn't it?
Pretty much. He literally says something like, think that demon, my cudgel, will bring instant success.
Love it. Does Tang Sun Zhang push back at all? Worry about the monster's power, maybe?
He does voice some concern, yeah. Like, are you sure? What if it's powerful? But Wukong just waves it off.
Of course he does.
His line is fantastic. Afraid of what power? If he knew old Sun was coming, he'd have nowhere to run. Pure Wukong bravado.
Okay, but there was something else in the dream, right? Something the Ghost King left.
Yes, exactly. Tang Sun Zhang remembers the king mentioning some kind of proof, a treasure left behind.
And let me guess, Baji thinks that's nonsense too.
You got it. Baji's like, Master, come on. It was just a dream. Don't read too much into it. Still the skeptic.
Right. But Shaoseng, the quiet one, he usually has a more thoughtful take.
He does. Shaoseng chimes in with a proverb, something like, don't trust absolute honesty. Beware of seeming kindness.
Ooh, interesting. Adding a layer of caution there.
Yeah. A hint that things aren't always what they seem on this journey. So despite the different views, they're intrigued enough, or maybe worried enough, to investigate.
So they light a lamp, open the door. What do they find?
And there it is, right on the steps, in the moonlight, a gold inlaid white jade tablet.
Whoa.
Baji actually picks it up, asks what it is. And Wukong, he knows immediately.
What is it?
He identifies it as a yugi. It's a type of jade tablet, a ceremonial object often held by a king as a symbol of authority.
So not just some random object. This is significant.
Very significant. Suddenly the dream doesn't seem quite so dreamlike anymore. They have actual tangible proof.
Right. How does Wukong react now that there's physical evidence?
This completely convinces him. He's like, okay, it's real. There's a demon and taking him down. That rests on me.
He takes charge.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He even says something quite ominous to Tang Sun Zhang. He tells him, tomorrow you've got three low fortunes coming your way.
Three low fortunes. That sounds bad.
Yeah. He lists them. You'll be the scapegoat, you'll suffer resentment, and you'll encounter pestilence.
Yikes. What's Baji's reaction to that?
Predictably terrified. This is where Sun Wukong lays out the strategy. First part. He tells Tang Sun Zhang, tomorrow at dawn, you need to hold this box.
Okay.
Put on your fancy brocade cassock. That's his special robe, remember, a symbol of his mission.
Right, the important one.
And sit in the main hall, just reciting scriptures. Meanwhile, Wukong himself will sneak into the city and check things out.
Scout ahead. Makes sense.
His logic is, if there's a demon, he can figure out how to deal with it and gain merit. If not, well, they avoid stirring up trouble unnecessarily.
And Tang Sun Zhang agrees to this.
He does. He trusts Wukong's judgment, even if the plan sounds a bit strange already.
But it gets stranger, doesn't it? This isn't just about scouting. There's a whole deception involving the prince.
Oh, yeah. This is where it gets really elaborate. Wukong's next step is to lure the crown prince of Wuji to come see Tang Sun Zhang.
How?
Well, the plan is, when the prince shows up, Tang Sun Zhang needs to just slightly open the lid of that lacquered box.
Oh, why? What's the point of that?
Because Sun Wukong will have shrunk himself down to be just 2 inches tall.
No way.
Yes, he'll be hiding inside the box, transformed into this tiny little monk.
Okay, that is peak Sun Wukong, using his powers for trickery.
Totally. And Tang Sun Zhang's role here is absolutely crucial and, frankly, pretty terrifying for him.
What does he have to do besides open the box slightly?
He has to stay completely still and completely silent, no matter what the prince does.
No matter what.
Like even if the prince bows to him respectfully, or if the prince gets angry and orders his soldiers to arrest Tang Sun Zhang, tie him up.
Or even execute him.
Or even execute him. Wukong is very clear. Stay still, stay silent.
Wow. That's asking a lot. Tang Sun Zhang must be scared stiff. He's facing the royal authority here.
Absolutely. You can imagine the fear. But Wukong does offer some reassurance. He basically says, don't worry, I'm right here. If things get really bad, I'll protect you.
Okay, small comfort maybe, but it shows that bond they have. What if the prince asks questions? Tang Sanzen can't stay silent forever, surely.
Right. Wukong gives him specific lines. He should say they're bunks, envoys from the east, heading to the western heaven to get scriptures, and they're carrying treasures.
Oh, the treasure angle.
Exactly. And if the prince asks about the treasures, Tang Sanzang should show him the fancy brocade cassock, but call it only a third-class treasure.
Hmm. Clever. Implying there's even better stuff.
Precisely. It's bait. Because the real focus is the box.
What should he say about the box?
This is the core of the deception. He needs to claim the box contains a treasure that, get this, knows everything. Past, present, future, for the last 1,500 years.
1,500 years. Seriously.
Seriously. The idea is that this treasure, which is really tiny, Wukong listening in, can reveal the whole truth about the king's dream, about the usurpation, directly to the prince.
And hopefully that convinces the prince to act.
That's the goal. Wukong hopes the prince will believe it, get angry, want revenge for his father, and then they, the pilgrims, will get the merit for helping sort it all out.
Makes sense as a plan, I guess. What if the prince doesn't buy the whole magic treasure box story?
Good question. The backup plan is to then show him the actual jade tablet, the Yugavi.
As concrete proof.
Right. But Wukong does worry about that a bit. He mentions the prince is young. Maybe you won't even recognize his own father's royal tablet.
A potential flaw. So how does Tang Sanzang feel about this incredibly risky, elaborate lie?
Surprisingly, he seems quite pleased with the plan's cleverness. He's actually delighted by the ingenuity.
Really? Even with the risk of execution?
Apparently so. He even asked Wukong what the name of this transformed treasure inside the box is.
Does Wukong give it a name?
He does. With a bit of typical flair, maybe a pun, he calls it Establishing the Emperor's Goods. Li Dihuo.
Establishing the Emperor's Goods. Okay.
Tang Sanzang carefully memorizes the whole plan, every step, with the group basically unable to sleep, just waiting for dawn, watching the stars fade, anxious to see how this whole audacious scheme plays out.
Early morning, dawn's just breaking in the east.
Uh-huh.
Tang Sanzang and the others, they're staying put at Balin Temple, and Monkey King is heading out for a look around.
And he doesn't waste any time. You know, classic monkey style. He just takes off with a somersault, leaps high into the air.
Getting that bird's eye view, yeah. From way up there, using those famous fiery golden eyes of his, he looks west.
Right.
He knows there's a city nearby, only about 40 lis away. That's what, maybe 12, 15 miles, something like that?
Yeah, roughly. Close enough that he can see it clearly from his aerial vantage point.
Okay.
And what he sees immediately tells him something really important about this place. The text actually describes the air over the city being thick with monster mist and sorrowful clouds.
Ooh.
There's this evil wind blowing. Resentment just hangs heavy everywhere.
Wow, that sounds incredibly ominous. It's not just like a visual description. It feels more like maybe a spiritual assessment of the place.
Precisely. Monkey contrasts this with what a city ruled by a true king should look like. He said, you know, it would have auspicious light, five colored clouds.
Oh.
So the sight of this black energy locking the golden gates tells him straight away that the dragon seat, basically the throne, has been invaded by some kind of monster. Something is fundamentally wrong at the heart of this kingdom.
So he's up there taking all this in, this deeply unsettling atmosphere, when suddenly the quiet is shattered.
That's right. He hears this loud cannon fire echoing up from the city.
Cannons, okay.
Yeah. And then through the east gate spills out this massive group of people. The source calls them a hunting army and really emphasizes they are truly powerful, imposing.
A hunting army. That's an intense way to describe a hunt. What does the scene look like as they come out?
Oh, the text paints such a vivid picture. It's still dawn, remember, and they're spreading out across the shallow grass outside the city. You can almost see it. Colorful flags catching the first sun, white horses galloping against the wind. You hear the dong dong sound of drums, the clash of spears. There are handlers with falcons, skilled generals with their dogs.
And the gear too, right?
Oh, the gear is everywhere. Cannons shaking the sky, these bird-catching poles reflecting the red sunlight. Everyone's armed, crossbow bolts ready, each person with a carved bow.
Wow.
And they're setting up nets on the mountain slopes, laying ropes along the small paths. It's serious.
It sounds incredibly organized, almost like military precision just for a hunt.
It really is. Yeah. And then there's this sound like a thunderclap, and 1,000 riders gather together, described like fierce, mythical beasts, these Pixiong. You should think like powerful bear-like creatures. It really emphasizes their sheer ferocity and collective power.
So this isn't just some leisurely outing, then. What are their targets? The description sounds almost ruthless.
Yeah, the text doesn't hold back on the prey's fate.
Yeah.
Cunning rabbits have no chance. Clever roe deer's wits are useless. Foxes are, like, destined to die. Elk will perish.
Jeez.
Mountain pheasants can't fly away. Wild chickens can't avoid misfortune. It's just absolute dominance being displayed.
And the goal is stated as picking over the mountains to capture fierce beasts, destroying forests woods to shoot flying insects.
Yeah.
That's not sport. It sounds more like a declaration of total control over the landscape.
Exactly. It shows the immense power this kingdom, or at least this force from the kingdom, wields. It's another piece of the puzzle, you know, building the picture of what's happening here. It contrasts that internal spiritual sickness Monkey saw with this huge outward display of overwhelming power.
Hmm. So this huge hunting party moves out, maybe about 20 long into the fields. And within that central group, Monkey spots someone who stands out.
He does. He sees a young general. The text mentions he's quite small physically, but he carries himself with this unmistakable, majestic air.
What does he look like? What are the details?
Well, he's wearing a helmet and armor. The source uses this interesting phrase, fruit belly, 18 wraps.
Okay.
Which probably refers to a specific type of, you know, layered or plated armor from back then. He's holding a precious sword, riding a striking yellow-spotted horse, and he's got a full bow ready at his waist.
And Monkey's reading him instantly, right? Like, he sees the image of a hidden king, a majestic imperial appearance, actions showing true dragon qualities.
Absolutely. Monkey recognizes those signs, royalty, maybe even destiny straight away. He puts it together and thinks, basically, no need to say more. That must be the emperor's crown prince.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a huge identification. This isn't just any general. It's potentially the heir to the whole kingdom.
Okay, so here's where it gets really interesting and very monkey-like. He decides he's going to have some fun, but, you know, with a purpose. He wants to play a trick on this prince.
Of course he does. What better way to engineer a meeting? He presses down his cloud, lands right there in front of the prince's horse.
And then, boom, classic transformation time.
Yep. Shakes his body and instantly becomes this small white rabbit and just takes off running wildly right ahead of the horse.
Okay, perfect bait for a hunt.
Exactly.
But
the prince sees this rabbit and is like totally delighted, a perfect target. He grabs an arrow, pulls his bow taut, shoots, and the arrow hits the rabbit square on.
But, and this is the key part, this was all Monkey's plan. He let himself get hit.
Right. He was quick enough to actually catch the arrow point with his hand, letting the fletching, you know, the feathers at the back fall off as he kept running.
That detail's amazing. It shows his incredible control, even while playing a trick.
Totally. So the prince sees his arrow hit, and naturally he's eager to claim his prize. He urges his horse forward, chasing alone now, leaving the rest of the hunting party behind.
And Monkey is just masterfully manipulating the chase. The text says he controls his speed perfectly.
Yeah.
If the horse goes fast, he runs like the wind. If it slows down, he just walks, always staying just ahead, just out of reach.
He's deliberately leading the prince, isn't he? Stage by stage, mile by mile, all the way to a very specific spot, the foot of the mountain where Balin Temple stands.
So they finally arrive at the temple gate. The rabbit vanishes, and what's left behind?
Just the prince's arrow, stuck firmly right in the wooden threshold of the gate.
Huh. Okay. The prince arrives, probably breathless from the chase. Sees the arrow, but no rabbit, and he's just completely astonished.
Yeah, he exclaims, strange, strange. My arrow definitely hit the white rabbit, but it's gone, and only the arrow is here. He's so bewildered, he actually starts speculating it must have been like a spirit or something, because the whole event was so weird.
Right.
So he pulls the arrow out, and then he looks up, and he sees the five large characters carved above the mountain gate.
Which means imperially decreed Balin Temple.
Exactly.
And that name, that clicks something for him. He realizes, ah, I know now. He remembers that years ago, his father, the king, had sent officials specifically to this monastery.
Right, with gold and silk to repair the Buddhist halls and statues. So there's a history here, a connection.
Interesting.
Yeah, it adds this layer of personal connection for the prince. He even quotes a little couplet, a bit of poetry. Because passing a monastery, I met a monk and talked. again, gaining half a day of leisure in this floating life. It sort of frames his next decision.
Yeah, it feels like that memory combined with the strange rabbit incident leads him to think, you know what? I might as well go inside and just take a look around.
Meanwhile, inside the temple, Monkey's already prepping for the prince's arrival.
Yeah.
He bursts in, finds Tang San Zhang, and says, Master, they've come, they've come.
Okay, mission accomplished in luring him there.
Yep. And then, another instant transformation, he changes into this tiny little monk, like just 2 inches tall.
2 inches?
Yeah. And ducks into a red box to hide.
Right.
Totally ready to observe the encounter he just, you know, engineered.
So, arrogant prince marches in, expecting, you know, everyone to bow down.
And when he walks into the main hall, what does he see?
Tang monk, just sitting there calmly.
Exactly. And this immediately makes the prince furious.
Right. From his view, it's total disrespect. He's the prince. He's got an army. You should stand up.
Precisely. Basic protocol in his world.
So he doesn't mess around, orders his guards, sees him, tie him up.
Yeah, pretty extreme. Just for staying seated. But this is where it gets interesting, because we know something the prince doesn't.
Wukong.
Wukong's hiding inside that red box Tang monk carries. And as the guards move in, Wukong isn't just sitting tight. He's silently casting a spell from inside the box.
Oh, right. He's calling on protection. The text mentions the Hufazu Tian and the Luding Lugia.
That's them. Powerful guardian spirits. Wukong basically tells them, protect my master.
And what happens?
Well, the guards try to grab Tang Monk, but they just can't
touch him.
Nope. Can't even touch his head. The text says it's like hitting an invisible wall.
Wow. So the prince sees this.
He sees the effect. He sees his guards unable to touch the monk. He calls it a hidden technique.
But Tang Monk denies it.
Completely. Plays innocent.
Hey!
Doing something, which, you know, just adds to the prince's confusion and frustration.
So the guards are stumped. Tang Monk seems totally unfazed, even though they just tried to arrest him.
Right. And he uses this moment, this confusion, to introduce himself.
He says he's a monk from East Earth heading west for scriptures.
Lion Temple. And he adds that he's also presenting treasures.
Which gets a reaction from the prince.
Yeah, a dismissive one. He basically scoffs. East Earth, that poor place. What treasures could you possibly have? Shows a bit of arrogance there.
But Tang Monk doubles down, claims his own robe, his cassock, is a treasure.
And then dangles the bait, says there are even better items in the box.
The box with Wukong inside. Clever.
Very. The prince looks at the cassock, still skeptical though. Calls it half covered, half exposed. Like, is this really it?
And Tang Monk responds with a poem.
He does. Launches into this description of the cassock. It holds true reality to countless stitches. It's righteous. Got pearls and treasures woven in, made by celestial maids.
Sounds impressive, if a bit standard for a holy relic description.
Exactly. It builds it up as this sacred object. And then the poem just completely shifts gears. The last line hits like a thunderclap.
What does it say?
It says, seeing the carriage and not greeting is forgivable. Your father's grievance is not yet avenged, living in vain.
Whoa. Okay. That's direct.
Incredibly direct.
From robe description to accusing the prince of neglecting his filial duty regarding his father's unavenged grievances.
That's a huge accusation.
So the prince must have exploded.
Oh, yeah. Furious.
Rascal monk, he yells. What are you talking about? My father's grievance. Explain yourself.
But Tang San Zhang doesn't answer directly, does he?
Nope.
He starts talking about the concept of kindnesses.
Kindnesses, like obligations.
Right. It feels like a total non sequitur, but it's clearly a setup.
So the prince, maybe still angry but also confused, lists the standard ones.
Yep. Heaven, earth, sun, moon, kingland, and parents. The big four.
And Tang Monk jumps on that last one.
Immediately. He questions the parents' kindness, suggesting maybe the prince is missing that specific kind of nurturing.
Ouch.
And then he brings it back to the box. He says something in the box, something called Li Di Hu, knows things, ancient things.
Knows past and future for 1,500 years.
That's the claim. And specifically knows why the prince might be lacking that parental kindness.
So Li Di Hu is clearly Wukong's alias here.
Absolutely. Tang Monk is basically saying the answer to this deeply personal, insulting question I just raised is inside this box.
The prince has to see it now. He must be reeling from all this, the disrespect, the magic, the poem, the accusation, this kindness talk.
He's hooked. Angry, confused, maybe a little intrigued. He demands Tang Monk show him this Li Dio.
Out pops.
Wukong. But the text says he's tiny at first, like a little star-like person darting around.
Huh. And the prince's reaction?
Complete dismissal. Looks at this tiny thing and basically laughs. This little speck knows the future, knows about my father.
Underestimating the Monkey King. Big mistake.
Huge. So Wukong decides to make an impression. He stretches.
He starts growing.
Just a bit at first, maybe 3 or 4 kind of a few inches. Yeah, but it happens so fast.
It startles the soldiers nearby.
Yeah, they panic. Where he'll prop up the sky, Cheng Poqing. Like, this little thing has immense power.
And then he just grows to his normal size.
Yep. Stops growing, stands there in his usual form. Point made.
Okay, so now the prince is facing regular-sized Wukong. Does he still doubt him?
He's probably wary now, but still challenges him. Ask how he knows the future. Does he use the old methods? Turtle shells, yarrow stalks, like the I Ching.
Asking about traditional divination.
Right. And Wukong's response is pure arrogance. Classic Wukong.
Let me guess. I don't need that stuff.
Pretty much. Not one bit, he says. All he needs is his 3-inch tongue to know everything.
Bold claim. How does he back it up?
He starts laying out facts. Specifics about the kingdom.
And this is where Wukong drops the first big truth bomb. You are the son of the Wuji King.
Okay, identifying him directly.
Then he recounts the past. The 5-year drought. The king praying desperately.
The arrival of the Taoist priest.
Exactly, from Zhongnan Mountain. The prince would know all this.
Exactly. Wukong mentions the Taoists could summon rain, turn stone to gold. How the king befriended him.
And the prince confirms it.
Explicitly. The text says he keeps saying, you're right, yes, yes, yes. He's hooked now, urging Wukong to keep going.
So Wukong's built credibility. Now the big question.
Right. Wukong asks, okay, it's been 3 years since that Taoist, that true immortal, supposedly left. So who's the king now?
Ooh, loaded question. How does the prince answer?
He tells the story as he knows it. Confirms his father and the Taoists were like brothers, shared everything. Says, 3 years back, in the imperial garden, the Taoist used a magic wind, took the king's white jade gi, that's a ceremonial tablet.
Right, importantly symbol.
And vanished, supposedly back to Zhongnan Mountain. Since then, the king misses him, sealed the garden. But the prince insists, my father is still the king.
And Wukong's reaction to this confident assertion.
He just laughs and laughs. The text says laughing continuously.
Just mocking him silently. That's brutal.
It's incredibly effective. It tells the prince, without saying a word yet, that his whole understanding is wrong. Even ridiculous.
And infuriating, I bet.
Definitely.
Yeah.
The prince demands to know why he's laughing. Wukong then hints, you know, this isn't something I can say in front of everyone.
Smart move. Build the suspense, ensure privacy.
Exactly. And the prince orders all 3,000 troops out of the hall.
So now it's just Tang Monk, Wukong, and the prince.
Just them.
Yeah.
Wukong drops the bomb. No more hints.
What does he say?
He says, straight up, the person blown away by the wind, that was your real father. The guy on the throne now, that's the Taoist, the imposter.
Wow. Just lays it out there.
Mm.
How does the prince take that?
Disbelief. Anger, he argues. Says the kingdom's been peaceful, prosperous since the Taoist left. How could that be if his father wasn't ruling?
Makes sense from his perspective.
He even threatens Wukong again, says his father would execute him for such slander.
So denial and threats. Wukong needs more proof.
Well, Wukong tries a different tack. He turns to Tang Monk, almost theatrically, and says something like, okay, fine, let's just give him the treasure and get our travel pass.
The treasure being the jade gi.
Almost certainly implying that the thing the real king lost.
So the prince, now he points at Tang Sunzang and accuses him of being the Taoist in disguise.
Wow.
And Tang Monk freaks out.
Completely. He yells out, be my wen.
Ooh, the stable boy insult.
Wukong, you idiot. Look what trouble you've caused.
But Wukong uses this chaos.
He does. Steps forward, calms things down, and finally reveals his true identity.
Not Li Diho.
No. He says, I am Sun Wukong, great sage equal to heaven, eldest disciple of the Tang Monk. Full introduction.
Okay, claiming his real power and status. Then what?
Then he tells the full story, but frames it cleverly. As a dream Tang Monk had the night before.
A convenient dream.
Very. He recounts this dream where Tang Monk saw it all. The Taoist murdering the real king, dumping the body in the octagonal well in the garden.
The sealed garden.
Exactly. And the Taoist taking the king's form. Wukong explains the officials, the prince himself, couldn't tell the difference. The garden was sealed to hide the body.
And the dream included the real king asking for help.
Yes, Wukong says the king's spirit came to Tang Lung in the dream, begging him to expose the imposter and avenge him. He reveals he was the jade rabbit the prince shot while hunting earlier that day. Says he let himself be shot specifically to lead the prince to the temple. So really, Wukong could tell him all this. He brings up the jade gi again. Reminds the prince he recognized its significance when it was mentioned earlier.
Implying Wukong somehow showed it or proved knowledge of it.
Right. And then Wukong connects it back to the kindness discussion. He asks, essentially, you recognized your father's treasure. So why aren't you thinking about that parental kindness you value and seeking revenge for your murdered father?
Wow. Tying it all together. Facts, dream, magic, evidence, and emotional duty.
It puts the prince in an impossible position. He's described as totally conflicted. Part of him thinks this is crazy talk. But too many things fit.
It's unthinkable. Stuck. Doesn't know which way to turn.
Makes perfect sense. He sees the guy on the throne every day looking like dad, acting mostly like dad.
But then Sun Wukong comes along and plants the seed of doubt. And he just can't shake it.
And that's the crux of it, isn't it? How do you verify someone's identity when they're that close to you? Especially the king.
You can't just walk up and ask, excuse me, your majesty, are you actually a demon?
No. That probably wouldn't end well. Any challenge is basically treason. Mm. Wukong gets this. They need solid proof. And it needs to come from someone whose word is undeniable. Someone intimately familiar with the real king.
And it has to be done quietly.
Wukong knew about the drought, the Taoist, the sealed garden. He knew about the gi. The rabbit story is bizarre, but explains why he's even there. It feels terrifyingly plausible.
So Wukong sees him wavering. What's the next step?
He offers a way to check, a practical test, not just relying on Wukong's word or magic dreams.
What's the test?
Go back to the palace. Go see your mother, the queen.
Ah, the queen!
Wukong tells him. Go talk to her. Ask her privately about her relationship with the king now versus 3 years ago. Is the affection the same? Is the intimacy the same?
Because an imposter wouldn't feel right.
Exactly. Wukong bets that the queen's own experience, her feelings, will reveal the difference. It's a deeply personal, emotional proof.
That's actually brilliant. It shifts the proof to something the prince can verify through someone he trusts implicitly.
It does, and it works. The prince, still maybe not fully convinced but willing to test it, agrees. He'll go talk to his mother.
But Wukong has specific instructions, right? Can't just charge it.
Crucial instructions. He tells the prince, go alone, single person, single horse. No entourage. Don't make a scene.
Why the secrecy?
Use the back gate, the who's I man. Speak quietly to your mother. Don't let anyone overhear.
Because the imposter
is powerful. Wukong warns him. If that monster figures out you suspect him, or what you're planning, both you and your mother are dead.
High stakes indeed.
The highest.
So the prince gets it. He understands the danger.
Yes. He takes Wukong's instructions very seriously. Orders his officers to wait at the temple encampment.
And rides back alone?
Alone and fast, heading straight for the palace, for his mother, and for the truth.